yourself, how will you disrupt yourself?
On today's show.
My job is simple. It's to get people to places they never thought they were capable of.
Welcome back to the Disrupt Yourself podcast, where we provide strategies and advice on how to climb the S-curve of learning in your professional and personal life, stepping back from who you are to slingshot into who you want to be. I'm your host, Whitney Johnson. Our guest today is Howard Morgan, who at the age of 13 started his first company. Today, that company generates $130 million a year, and Howard spends about 7 hours a year working there. If that sounds like a good time, well, there's a lot more to that story. Howard is incredibly accomplished and has a very strong work ethic. But frankly, those were table stakes. The real conversation for today's episode is about his relentless optimism. He believes things will work out, largely because he builds a culture of trust and respect wherever he goes. Howard recently shared 10 wonderful stories from his life with me, and I wanted to learn more about them. I'm confident you will be energized by what he shares. Howard, you and I were in a mastermind group together a few months ago, and during that mastermind, we had a session where you shared a number of stories and lessons learned from your life. And I was so taken by them and found them so compelling and interesting. I thought that our podcast listeners would find them useful as well. And so I would love for you, it's going to be story time with Howard, to share some stories, some lessons that you've learned. And let's start with the very first one, which was the importance of hard work. What's your story around that?
Interesting. Yeah, it's and thanks for asking. It started all with my grandfather. And my grandfather's dad came from Russia. He went to Switzerland. He then went to Regina in Canada and ended up in a place called Nelson. And I would describe us primarily as being lower income, but rich family life. And we didn't know better. So, for example, we had made a full-time diet out of Spam or Prim, depending on which part of the country you're in. But, you know, one of the things that he had a great influence on is he took a positive attitude towards everything regarding work. He had 8 children. They were over, I think it was 16 years, difference in age. And they were rich with love. But what was more important is he believed in getting people very early into understanding the value of work. To this day, I always chuckle that he gave me the hard work vibe, because what happened was that he would have me, we were in literally a horse-drawn carriage, and he'd have me run back and forth to take the coins out of the milk bottle and bring new milk bottles. I think it was probably a trick on his part, but it was highly effective, and I loved it. It was great. And that sort of carried on to my dad, who...
Wait, back up. So you're in this horse-drawn carriage, and you're going along, and what is he having you do?
What happened is that in the olden days, if you wanted milk, you put a milk bottle with a token or money on the porch.
Yep.
And my job was to run from the carriage to the porch, get that out. Good days where there weren't many tokens. I would then run back, get a bottle of milk, and carry it all the way back to the porch and come back. And he would tell me how great a job I'm doing. And there wasn't a day, I mean, he would, in true farmer fashion, he would get up at 5, he'd work until 9, the big meal would be at lunch. It's very interesting how you learn how to work hard when you're around people that don't see it as working hard. Mm. It's what he did to provide for his family and also the joy he got out of it, even though he had enough hardship in his life. But he saw the value in that.
Huh.
So I think sometimes, and it carried on even to my dad, who we would, no matter, even though he didn't have to, he would average 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. And his idea of a great family vacation was going in an old beat-up Austin between Nelson and Spokane. Now, to give you some idea, it's probably 2.5-3 hours, of which the car would break down no less than 5 or 6 times. We'd be at the side of the road, normally in the middle of the winter, and him cussing and us playing games. But it was family time. And even then, He was very good at sort of instilling that question of, if you want to get the best out of life, you have to put more into it, and then you'll get more out of it.
And so your dad modeled for you hard work. I assume your mother worked hard as well, and you just learned the value of it. But it sounds like you also learned the joy of working hard.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Whitney. And let me tell, because there's many listeners that are going to obviously be women. And, you know, sometimes I think we don't give enough credit to mothers. But let me tell you why that's important. So my mother, and this horrifies me this day, horrifies me. My mother, on a Friday, she was getting married on a Saturday in 1946. On the Friday, the boss walked in and said to her, "Well, we've organized a little coffee event for you, because now that you're getting married on Saturday, of course, you have to give up your job for a single woman." And that's how she found out she was no longer working there. 1 hour's notice, took it like a trooper, was a great mother. And to this day, one of my greatest fights with her, and she's 98 now, one of my greatest fights with her is getting to understand that maybe women can work. because she grew up in those times, right?
Uh-huh.
And she's come a long way. But you know, I think hard work is a model that's good for anybody that you're trying to influence.
And thank you, RBG, because she's made a difference for women like your mom and for all the rest of us. Lesson number two is, I'm going to say it, and then I'm going to ask you to riff. Never judge a person until you know what is inside.
Yeah, this was probably one of the most formative times of my life. And as I went to school, we moved, like many people do now. We moved locations, but where that found me was in a junior high. So kind of, I think it was 7 to 9, a junior high school, of which every other person in the district, when they were expelled or they failed, got sent to that school because there wasn't much of a population around, right? People had moved to different areas. So I found myself in a school where certainly I was probably heavier than I should be. I would be bullied. People would fundamentally pick on me all the time. And I'm not sure I would ever say that it was a planned event, but one of the things that leads you to is, so who isn't going to bully you? Well, there was this person named Stacy. Stacy was a black gentleman. I think I was 13 and he was 18, and in my grade. He had failed 5 times, whatever that works out to. And it's where I, you know, really learned you have to look at what somebody's inside. And what I mean by that is, in his heart, he was a good person. Mm-hmm. He had a short trigger. He was somebody who hated to be disrespected. He just wanted to be listened to. And he had probably the strength and the stubbornness to uphold that. And as a result, I was probably one of the only people in school that would just talk to him as a person. And to this day, I would say with Stacy, if I ever needed something, don't know where he is, but I have every confidence that I could totally trust him. But he had a bad rap. I mean, I'll give you a classic example of it for me. It was my French class, because being in Canada, we, of course, learn French. And it was my grade 8 French class. And what happened was that we had a French teacher, you'd never get away with it these days, but a French teacher that would ask for an interpretation, a translation, and would start whapping you on the head with a ruler if you didn't get it, and keep whapping until you gave the right answer. Well, one day, she was doing this with Stacy, and Stacy obviously had enough. He picked up the ruler and broke it over her head. So she sent him to the principal's office, and I was sitting there, and all of a sudden over the PA of the school comes, "Well, Howard Morgan, please come to the principal's office." So I'm fine. I go down there, and I get there, and here's Stacy sitting outside the principal's office. I go in to see the principal, and the principal says, "You have to talk to Stacy." And I'm going, "Why me?" Said, "Because I'm afraid of him." And he said, "He's not going to listen to me." And I said, "Well, maybe you should try." And he said, "Well, I want you to tell him." And I said, "Well, look, first of all, the teacher's wrong too. So whatever you're going to do," so it's my early days of negotiations, is whatever you're going to do to him, you have to do something equal to the teacher. And in those days, the answer was, let's ignore it and pretend it didn't happen, right? That was the days. And it's a lesson that I've really thought about until today. I really try, and I'm guilty of it, but I really try not to judge people by the exterior, but who they are in their hearts, what their values are like. They may do things differently, but you never know where there's that diamond in the rough. Mm-hmm. And it especially applies today, where I believe there are a lot of really great people that have been so suppressed that someone just has to help reach out a hand and give them a help. Mm-hmm. Give you another quick example.
Wait, before you go on. So what happened in the principal's office? What happened? What was the outcome?
Oh, it was very simple. The principal said, well, I'm not talking with them, so you send them back to class. And of course, then the teacher said, principal sent me back. And in the end, it just disappeared. It went away. Except the French teacher didn't hit anybody in the head anymore.
Mm.
Right? So it's sort of like I always say, and this happened in my negotiating years too, you can't come in halfway through the story and start to make a conclusion about guilt.
Mm.
Right? You have to see the beginning and you have to see the end. I mean, in some ways, it's the same as the S-curve, right? You've got to figure out where's the real issue. I think we all sometimes, I mean, I'm guilty of it too, right? So I'll give you another one where we can slip and we can forget about what the person's like. And this happened to me probably 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And I was so proud of myself for a minute, only a minute, because this had this phenomenally talented woman working for me. And she came to me one afternoon and said, look, my child's ill. I got to go home. We're not sure what it is. The reason I was proud is I said, great, I'll tell you what, go home. Absolutely go home. That's the right thing to do. Do you think you get the project done for Friday? And she said, yeah, I think so. I think I can get it done. And here's where I failed. She came back the next day and said, okay, I'm back. I want to come back and tell you what I've done. My first question was, how's the project going? She started to answer and I stopped her and I said, my apologies. The project's not as important as your child. How's your child? We make those simple things, right? To her, what would she have heard, right? Now I had so much equity with her. So I think sometimes we just have to catch ourselves if we're trying to bring the best out in people and say, how do I value something that they find value in? Mm-hmm. How do I understand what's important to them?
It's interesting because you describe that as never judge a person until you know what's inside. But I wonder if one of the things I want to reframe is it so much judging or just being willing just to see people as a person? Because what were you judging? I guess that's the question. What were you judging in those instances?
Well, the first one's easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
color, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The second one was that I didn't stop and think about the fact she was one of the best people I had working for me, and she would solve it, right? It's kind of one of those things where sometimes as a leader, we do more than what we need to do. And as a result, I've always said, we tend to pick on our best talent more than our weakest talent. So in this case, I think it wasn't passing judgment, you're right. It was far more, was I willing to just start with the assumption that she would do the right thing?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, my role in this was not to not ask her about it, but the order in which I asked things,
mm-hmm.
right? And that I think is the real, real heart of the issue.
Yeah, it makes me think of, we both know Liz Wiseman, and she was on LinkedIn Live with me. And she wrote the book Multipliers and talks about accidental diminishers. And that yep. sounds like one of those instances where we accidentally diminish someone by forgetting that, in fact, they will do a fantastic job. And by assuming that they won't, we diminish them in some way.
That's right. And I think it tends to come out in us when we're pressured. And, you know, if there's one thing, and we may talk about it later, there's one thing from starting a company when you're 12, mm-hmm. you quickly learn how to let other people excel, and more importantly, let the story be about them.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I'm a strong believer of is I say this to people all the time. People ask me about a person or ask an event, and I'll go, "That's not my story to tell."
Mm.
Right? I'm a great believer of don't take away someone's joy or someone's if you've helped them, that's great. It's still their story. In fact, there's an hysterical movie clip from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Butch comes back after being away a while, and there's this person who's reading a news story. And Butch sort of cuts him off and says, okay, great. Thank you very much. Let's update ourselves. And the guy goes, no. We're getting to the good part. And then he gets the part where they mention his name. Everybody needs their moment of their name being in the headline, and we shouldn't take it from them.
So let's go to the next one, which is sometimes you don't have to be political to win.
So after I worked my way through school, and the way I did it was as a rock and roll radio announcer in the late 60s, which many people won't necessarily identify with, but it was dramatically different than it is today, because part of it was you could be as creative and fluid as you wanted to. You just lived in the danger zone. But as a result, if you were good at it, and I was pretty darn good at it, anything could happen. So my show became syndicated on 73 stations across the country. And as a result, you start getting all this demand, right? And people would, it was very interesting because people in that industry are horribly political, all about brown nosing, who's going to do what, who you know. And I just didn't care. So, because don't forget, I was going to school. So what happened was that I ended up as a result of that being a really good moderator. So I moderated for a couple of worldwide syndicated shows. One was Judy LaMarche, which won't mean anything to some people, but was a very powerful woman that was a member of parliament in Canada. And the second was Xavier Hollander, who was the happy hooker. And it was interesting because you looked in some ways for me, it was never about, it was what's the right thing to do? How do I want to conduct myself in the right way and avoid getting into the political drama? It carried through my whole career, by the way. I was horribly politically, still am.
Wait, but what was the political drama in this particular situation with those two stars?
Sure. The political situation was that there were probably, I don't know, 20, 30 people all trying to nip away at my heels to take the job away. They would find reasons why they thought the show wasn't good, and they would sort of go talk to the network and say, here's what's happening. And I'd go, that's fine. If you feel that way, I'm okay. There's nothing worse than accepting criticism and saying, if you believe that to be true, then that's okay. Mm. And I stand behind what I did. So political probably was, it would have been so easy to take on that fight. And I would have enough equity to probably win it. I just wasn't interested in fighting politics, although we all have to on some level, but not politics to the extent, probably the best way of putting it, that it didn't compromise my values. I think that's the difference. I think sometimes, and we're seeing it in the country now, right? So how do I stand for what I believe, but at the same time be an enabler rather than a critic?
And so the two people you mentioned, the Judy LaMarche and the happy hooker, were just people that you interviewed or moderated?
Very high profile. Yep.
You were moderating their shows or they worked together?
We worked together. I was actually their host.
So you moderated the two of them. So you had a happy hooker and a...
Two different shows.
Oh, two different shows.
Yeah, we might want to correct that. Two different shows. Terribly difficult people to get along with, except for me.
Because you didn't have to win.
Because I didn't have to win. Everybody else was playing a game, and both were very smart women, especially Judy. Judy was phenomenally talented. So she would just see through that stuff and swack.
Why is it that you don't have to win? Because it's not that you don't want to win. You just don't have to win.
Yeah, I think it's a great question because I've never really been, I'm competitive with myself. I'm not competitive with others. That's probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
So I will strive to be the best I can be, but I don't need that to be at someone else's price, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're trying to do their thing too. If I can help them, great. But who's, I mean, in some ways, if you start and you're lucky early, which I was, you get to the point where you go, this competition's unfair because what are all the factors that came about that allowed that to happen? Somebody else may not have that same opportunity. So for me, it's about how do you help each other as long as you feel in your heart that person is worthy of your time.
It is interesting also too that you said, because yes, you are white and yes, you are a male and you grew up in a lower income family. So it's not like there was privilege everywhere.
Not at all.
And yet you said you were lucky.
Well, it depends on what you define as luck, right?
Mm-hmm.
I call luck if you get a lot of love and you lay a lot of caring and you learn a lot of lessons and probably the luck comes into starting a company at 13 and it doing phenomenally well. I think there's a lot of skill. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of talent in everything we all do.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an element of luck, and it's about you just were in the right time or you had the right circumstances. So we've got to be careful. What we don't do is assume that nobody else could do what I do.
One of your stories is sometimes you also get lucky. So let's talk about that company that you started when you were 13 years old.
Yeah, I started with a consulting company on lotteries. When I was 13, so it was the right in 1963, the Irish sweepstakes was the only lottery in the world, to my knowledge. There might have been somewhere, but to my knowledge. And I had a vision that there was going to be somehow something that had to happen within Canada. I wasn't thinking beyond that. Canada that would have different lotteries as a way of creating money and proceeds for other causes, since it seemed to me it was kind of illegal. So what happened is all that money went out of the country. And I thought, well, there's bound to be something here. So I started this company, did nothing for 4 years, which probably was good because I was young. And all of a sudden it took off because places started doing lotteries. They needed counsel on lotteries. We were blessed enough to probably have the four largest initial ones. So what happens is, like anything, right? You've got in there before everybody else does. You have a vision. You're defining the market rather than following the market. And so as a result, this company, I mean, I think last year was $130 million in revenue. So it's not a small company, not large, but not small.
Just a second. First accelerant of personal disruption for everybody who's listening. Play where no one else is playing. Take on market, not competitive risk, which is exactly what you did. Keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. I was before my time listening to you.
I was whispering in your ear from heaven.
There you go. That's right. There you go. So then, you know, I think then the challenge comes from, which really we can go through the whole S curve, is that it's how do I select people that will fit this industry, fit really what is a growing, non-existing, defined industry, and probably pick people that everybody else would think I'm crazy. And I got to tell you, that's exactly what happened. I picked people that they were in some ways the mavericks, right?
Huh.
But they had good values.
Yep.
And the net effect was that they built this phenomenally successful company. I would say I helped. But one of the things that I've always used this company as, Whitney, is it's like my little Petri dish, because it's a company where I really spend, I don't know, 7 hours a year, right? It's run by the people. I go to the Christmas party. You talked about sort of rewards of what you get out of it a while ago. For me, I get letters from people's grandchildren talking about how this company allowed their grandma to pay for their whole school. The average length of service in this company is now dropped a bit. I think it's 21 and a half years. And I think you start recognizing that even though some of these people would have probably not existed in a normal organization, they had the talents and the insights. And when you let them loose, it was just a question of building some flexible walls to keep them on the track.
All right. So the one story is sometimes you also get lucky. So you had this idea, you're 13 years old, you start a company and you were right. And so 4 years later, lotteries become a thing. And now you've got $130 million in revenue. Okay. So that's sometimes you get lucky. Now you've kind of segued to another lesson, which is you know how to hire people. You're able to identify talent. You're able to identify people who are at the launch point of the curve, perhaps, and help them match to a curve that makes sense for them. Tell us about one hire that you've made that people would have looked at you askance. Why are you hiring that person? And yet they turned out to be fantastic.
I'll keep names out of it, but the person would be someone who had real trouble keeping a job.
Mm-hmm.
They had real trouble with not challenging their boss all the time.
Okay.
They had real difficulty with believing that they were valued. And I think for me, I've always found, And I, to this day, I've always found if you talk to people and demonstrate respect, they will return in kind. I really believe that. And this person, I mean, you got to go through that. It probably was a 3-month gauntlet because they're still wounded, right? So there was something there that said, this person is going to be creative. They're going to come up with solutions that in a startup, they're going to come up with solutions that are going to allow you to accelerate at a rate that's going to get you to that sweet spot real quick. And then you can start being very creative, right? Once you get that part. Because needless to say, once you had those lottery businesses start to come into fruition, the problem is it scaled up real quick. So because it was a lot of money and states and provinces all decided this was something they can make a lot of money off of.
Okay, I have two questions. One is, during that 3 months where they're testing you basically, right?
Yep.
They're saying, okay, you say this is going to work, but I don't really believe you yet. So they got in there. So they're going to test, push the boundaries. What do you do during those 3 months to help them say, oh no, this is safe? Because that's really what they're saying. This isn't going to be safe. And you're saying, no, it will be safe. What are you doing?
I think the biggest thing you're doing is you're saying to the person, this is a we, not an I.
Mm-hmm.
Being very careful and articulate why I hired them.
Yep.
And saying, what I'm looking for is some of the things that probably you're frustrated by you didn't have in your old job. What I need back from you is I need not to be screwed over.
Yep.
Right. So I just, and I think total honesty, which I mean, probably it took Whitney a month, 5 weeks. And then the person started saying, okay, what about this? I call it the little test, right? What about that? I said, fine. Do you think that's going to work? I'll let you run with it if you think it's going to work. Well, eventually they say, well, no, I'm not sure that'll work. So I think highly creative, talented people need to have latitude. And part of it is they need to also understand, I'm a strong believer of, they don't do everything well. None of us do.
Yeah.
Right. We do hopefully majority well. So part of it is saying, look, you help me on this, I'll help you on that. And it becomes a partnership. So I think every good leader scenario for 90% of the people is a partnership.
And you were very clear about what the parameters were. One of the things I'm thinking as I'm hearing you talk about all these people that you've worked with and hired is that you need to go back and pay Stacy from elementary school and her full consulting fee. Because basically what he did is he taught you this.
He sure did.
He taught you this. So I think you need to go find him and tell him.
Well, you've introduced a new concept. I did go back about 20 years later. So it would be what, in the 80s. Tracked him down.
Yeah.
And I gave him $5,000 as a thank you.
Oh, you did?
I knew he wouldn't have a huge amount of money. So I tracked him down. He was, as you can imagine, he was struggling a bit. And you know what's interesting is, and you'll appreciate this, I gave him the $5,000. It's what I said to him had more value than the $5,000.
What did you say?
I just said, you need to understand that as rough a life as you had, you made mine better. And while a lot of people probably have not seen that sparkle in you that I did, I just want you to let you know I see it, I value it, I respect it, and you'll always be, if anything you need, you know, you just call.
Wow. Okay. I'm realizing there's a part of the story you left out. How did he make your life better? What did he do? Did he defend you against the bullies?
Yes, I didn't get bullied. Matter of fact, it's not only didn't he get bullied, I had to sort of calm him down because the one time I got bullied, I remember we were in the school cafeteria and these two guys are coming over and pushing me, you know, typical things they do, right?
Yeah.
I see out of my corner of my eye, I see Stacy coming and I go, shoot. Stacy takes one of these guys by his pants and his back of his collar and throws him down the whole dining table. Nobody said anything. And it's an interesting subject, Whitney, because I think we really want to value and we really want to remember those that are important to us. Sometimes we don't do it as much. So pursuant to your question to me, I would give a challenge to the people that are listening to say, go back to somebody, probably a teacher, somebody that made a huge difference in your life. I either find it's a grandparent, could be a parent, could be a teacher. But I challenge you to go back and write a note from the heart, not to their head, to their heart about why they made, in essence, a pivot point in their life. There's a price to pay for most people that do that. I was thinking companies. So let's take in companies. The best people don't always get to the top. There are some people in the middle that do everything. They're disruptive. They're doing everything they can to make this a good place for talented people, and the company doesn't value it. They just go, well, you got, you know, short term, you're not getting as much done with the people you have. Yeah, because they're getting way better. They're learning mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. So I think those people do it for the story that they hear in the future, the one that you're going to write for them, that you're going to say, look, you made a difference. When we all sit in our rocking chairs, two or three of those stories, and I'm happy with my life.
All right. I'm thinking about who I'm going to write my letter to.
Perfect.
So let's go to overhead is evil.
Every time I've worked in a company, one of the things that happens is we have a tendency to go and invest in nice little office and desks and we hire staff. All of that's not bad. It's which order are you doing it in? Mm-hmm. If it's one that's coming after the demands there, that's great. A lot of people do it, so I'm ready. If you develop a lot of overhead, it causes you to make bad decisions because you have to pay your overhead. Mm-hmm. There's a company that I can think of where I won't name them, but I went in to work with them and they were something like $50 million in debt. So 15 million bucks. I said, well, why? Because what they were doing was something that didn't make sense because it was a profitable business. Well, they had boats, they had apartments, they had everything else. And in the end, all I did is said, look, why don't you just reverse that? And how much are your clients really going to care if you got a boat? I mean, you're buying it for somebody in the company. You're not buying it for somebody you're serving by the company. So I've always said that overhead is you need it. You just don't want it to control you. You want to control it, probably the best way to put it.
I'd love for you to talk about the future is great and happiness abounds if you learn from the past.
Okay. Can I deal with one quick one before that?
Absolutely. Which one?
I want to deal with the one, if you treat someone as an adversary, they'll be an adversary.
Okay. Go for it.
In my early formative years, in my 20s, I ended up in the labor relations industry. And I was somebody that got, as I've done three or four times in my life, I always went into jobs where I dropped my pay in half to take something that I'd never done before. Well, in this particular case, I took on a labor relations role in Canada, which is heavily unionized. Not as much anymore, but it was. And
I need you to pause you for a second. So everybody notice how what he said. He took a job in an industry that he'd never been in before at half the pay. That is stepping back in order to grow. Okay, keep going, Howard.
Yeah, and by the way, done it three or four times, always works. You have to believe in yourself and be willing to invest in yourself. So I arrived my first day in the job, having never done this job before. I end up with, all of a sudden, the union person walking in with 225 grievances. Ooh. And saying, here you go, deal with these. And so I ended up from the labor relations board for like 3 months, which really was not conducive to me learning much other than dealing with the conflict. Well, I'll give you the short story. The short story was that over a period of probably 2 years, I became very well known in the labor relations circles as somebody that always would do what was right. For example, we went in the company from spending 5 days a week having meetings with the union to 2 hours. Because I'd say, I'm never talking about something twice. If I need to check on it, we'll table it, but I'm not talking it twice. The other thing was that was brought into the scenario because there had been
Before you go on. So an issue would come up and you'd say, we're going to talk about it once and we're going to resolve it and then we're going to move on.
Right. Or we'll table it and fix it and come back. But we're not going to keep dealing with something that's disruptive.
Okay, got right? it.
It's keeping us from going where we need to go.
Got it. Okay.
So what happened was that this is an it was in the beverage industry. It was an industry where it was very capital intensive. They had had work stoppages every 2 months for 50 years.
Wow.
So what I fundamentally started doing was just saying, okay, we're going to stop this. And if so, my best part of this was that they had a work stoppage at the cafeteria, and all the people were doing a sit-in. So this was probably 9 in the morning. And of course, so I got arranged other people to serve the meals because this is healthcare. So other people did the meals. And they phoned and said, well, are you coming over? I said, sure. So I came over and I talked and said, they said, well, we want you to talk to us, as in union reps and people in there. We want you to talk to us before we go back to work. And I said, not a chance. You go back to work, we'll talk. You have my word. So it got to be 4 o'clock. And some people had already left the little sit-in. And they phoned me and they said, are you coming over? And I said, no, actually, I'm just about to go home, but I'll see you in the morning. Nobody was there in the morning. But they also knew that I would do what was right. So over time, I ended up having such a good relationship with things like Teamsters, really hardcore unions, that they would actually hire me to work with their office unions. Not because I was union-leaning, but I was fairness-leaning. So I think you have to look inside yourself and say, okay, can I be part of the solution or am I part of the problem? Especially right now, right, with what we're going through. I have to take ownership for me.
Why do you think that worked when you said, I'm not going to talk to you now, but I'll talk to you when you go back to work?
It's a little bit your model, right? It was breaking the normal thing. Here's the normal thing. They would sit down because they were mad at something.
Mm-hmm.
They would have management come over and talk with them. They would say, okay, we'll go back to work. They would then, if you do everything we want, they would sort of say, yeah, and then they'd go back to work, right? And then they wouldn't quite live up to everything and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's recognizing, in this case, a union is an employer.
Mm-hmm.
It has people it serves. So for me, it was always about, I can always remember there was a phrase that head of the Teamsters said to me once, and he said, you know, what you've turned out to be is my best friend. Because it's a membership I can't always go against, but what you've done is make it so that you can be the whipping boy.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the issue. The issue is, a lot of the time, here's another activity for your listeners. This activity is to take a piece of paper and write down the 5 people in their life that they say would be with them thick or thin.
Mm.
And then take the 5 that they think would probably fade and go away. Hang on to it for about 10 years and see what happens. Because what I do this all the time with clients, especially executives, because they'll go, okay, I've got a solid team. They're there. The people that end up staying in contact with them are the ones they least expect.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they're not telling them what they want to hear. They're telling them what they need to hear. So therefore, sometimes I think we need to surround ourselves by people that are really trying to help us. And sometimes we shut the door too quick.
So basically what you're saying with the Teamsters or the unions in general is that you would say, we'll talk, but you need to go back to work. And once you go back to work, we'll have a conversation. But they trusted that you would then do whatever it is needed to be done in order to move things forward.
Right. No matter what. So for example, if I made a commitment, I would, no matter what I need to do, I would live up to that commitment. And all I did, if you think about it, Whitney, is ask them to do the same. That's all I was doing. Again, it comes back to, if I want all of us to be happy, we have to respect each other and not play games.
Okay. So the future is great and happiness abounds if you learn from the past.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a phrase that I use for myself. I'm not sure it's any good, but I use it, which is, we can't change our past, but we can use it to influence and design our future.
Mm.
I think a lot of the time what we do is we live too much in the past. I think we have to take, there's plenty of good things that happen to all of us, right? We let ourselves get captivated by either listening to people that are critical. So case in point, you and I could publish something. First thing we do is go look and see who said bad things. Sometimes what we don't do is say, what's the good stuff?
Uh-huh.
Sometimes a challenge I give to people I work with, I say, I want you as a family once a day over the dinner table to talk about one thing each of you did that day that you feel proud of.
Mm.
It is amazing how it transforms everything, right? How simple is that? Just talk about one thing that you thought you made a difference.
When you think about your life and the various S-curves you've been on, which was the most challenging for you and why?
Well, I can talk about the circumstance. I think the most challenging is the one we sort of touched on a little bit a second ago. I think the challenging one is saying, when you're in that sweet spot, it's about saying, how do I separate good data from bad data? How do I, in essence, disrupt, but disrupt based on something that should happen? Because I think one of the things I find is everybody tries to craft your solution. I'm all about help them figure out what's right for them. Because each of us has such a background, we have differences. I believe in the value of every person. It's how that gets manifested. So for me, that was the big challenge. It's so hard getting those critical things. Or, I mean, I've had three or four bosses in my life that have said, you do know if this doesn't work, you're getting fired.
Really? Three or four times?
Well, the one's my favorite. One would hide from me for 4 months. He hid from me. And he said, I know you're doing something that you know I wouldn't approve of. And if it doesn't work, you're fired. I said, I can live with that. I'm not saying everybody has to go to that extreme, but I think you have to figure out, what do I stand for? And I think one of the things we don't talk about enough in our field is it's a continuum. So if it's about taking risk, how far can I go? Mm-hmm. Maybe I can't be crazy like Howard, but I can go 20% of the way. Well, that's a victory. And what we should do is acknowledge that, right? When it happens, say, instead, don't go, well, that's great, but you got another 80% to go.
Yeah. All right. So your most challenging S-curve was negotiating with unions.
Yeah, by all means.
But that was 20 years ago. You haven't had something really big and challenging and hairy in the last 20 years?
Oh, you just asked the biggest one. I didn't. I have them all the time. Another one more recent is, how do I want to spend my time for the rest of my life? For me, it's about learning to be a positive influencer, not an expert. I probably started 10 years ago. I'm not sure exactly when I started this, but is how to help other people be the best they can be without me being, I can be the conduit and help that, but I'm not the answer giver. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that's hard in our business is to avoid giving answers, right? My job is simple. It's to get people to places they never thought they were capable of.
So basically, you're now focusing your time on coaching. And what kinds of problems do people come to you? So what's a typical, like, they come to you and they say, Howard, I need your help. Who comes to you?
I think a lot of the time it is people that probably have, it's almost back to my early days, right? That have phenomenal talent. It's how can they disrupt when they're living in a box where the walls keep coming in, right? So it's helping them understand, again, I think what we're not good at is separating the 5% from the 100%. So maybe they start with 5%. So I help them with that. I think some cases I just give them the courage that what they're saying is right. They're going in the right direction. I see me as a facilitator of the action, not the driver of the action. I think you have to find out from people what's in their heart and what they want to do and help them discover it versus say them, here's what you ought to do. I'm out of the here's what you want to do business. I'll throw out one example that I think is important, is especially as we're going through the challenges of work at home. An example that that happened, which on a Zoom call, as we all perfect now, and this woman was working and her child came in. Person was absolutely horrified, apologized, and my comment was, like your cat.
You're talking to our listeners. As soon as Howard said that, my cat walked in. That's hilarious. Okay. On cue.
Yes, but, yeah. Perfect. That was well done. The poor woman was horrified. I'm sorry that I tried to keep them out. My answer is, why are you horrified? And by the way, why shouldn't we support that, right? So I think what we have to do, I think now is the time where we have to take a look and say, we can either make a great step forward or a great step back. And it's all about if that person, I could, sorry, I'm hopping around, but I'll tell you, it's just such a funny story.
Yeah.
I literally almost got fired once for hiring a pregnant woman.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah.
What year was this? In the
1969?
Oh, in the 60s.
70? Okay. Oh, yeah, the good old days.
Okay.
Because what happened is I knew it. She was good. She said, just, you know, Howard, before you hire me, I'm 3 months pregnant. I said, fantastic. You know, I'll need a few months off. Fantastic. Boss found out and said, you hired a pregnant woman. What are we going to do for 4 months? And I said, same thing we've done for the last 4 months. Somehow we made it work.
Wow.
So, you know, I think we just have to see this moment we're in now as a huge opportunity to take leaps and bounds from then. Leaps and bounds from my mother and having to lose her job and say, how do we look at each other and take a look and rely on people's commitment, their values, to do the right thing and recognize there's going to be some bumps.
What advice would you give every 20-year-old who is listening?
I would say never give up on being committed to self-improvement. I think that's, in fact, it was interesting, but Nikki read your newsletter last week and the story of the university. And the first thing it triggered to me, it's discussion for another day, was the relationship between commitment to self-improvement and disrupting yourself, right? Because if I think 20-year-olds, we come out of school with, I know everything. And that's okay, right? There's reasons for that and we're okay. But how do you say, I'm going to find the right people to attach my learning to and grow with them and pick people that are interested in my success, not people that are interested in me as a work conduit. That would for 20-year-olds. Because I think if they start that early, they're kind of like me. They'll reap the benefits later.
What advice would you give to a 40-year-old? Because I think it's very different advice, right?
Well, first of all, I would say the same thing to start off with. But
yeah.
I think it's different advice. I think by 40, we've accumulated knowledge.
Uh-huh.
My question is, have we figured out how we can apply that knowledge to build understanding, to help others, and also to build our success in whatever occupation is? It's a major point where you can disrupt at 40. Because I think most people by the time they're 40 may have had families. They've had to drive all the millions of kids around to the event. It's kind of a rediscovery age.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is avoid settling in and being complacent. Treat it as something where this is your chance to really get paid back for those sacrifices you've made in up to 40.
Yeah. I think about, you know, Eric Erickson and developmental psychology. And I think, you know, at 40, you do have this impulse to want to make a big shift. And that's why sometimes people go out and make really stupid decisions and, yep, you know, do stupid things. And I think if you can be aware of it and acknowledge it and say, I'm having this yearning, I want to do something different, and honor that and recognize that you do need to do something different, because you're going to end up doing something different regardless. So just make sure that you use it as an impetus to do something productive and disrupt yourself in positive ways.
I think that's well put. I think the real challenge sometimes comes from, we go to try to find something that's fun.
Mm.
I don't believe in fun. I believe in satisfaction. Mm. If you can have fun while you're being satisfied, that's great. But fun is a very, we go out at some night, we have fun. We're forgetting it about it in 2 days.
Right.
Satisfaction comes from, it made a difference in my life and I'm going to incorporate that piece.
Right.
In my future.
So what are you reading and or listening to right now that's compelling that you would recommend?
Well, first of all, I listened to Oodles Martin and his, you know, the...
Martin Lindstrom?
Yeah. His latest book I thought was wonderful. But
The Ministry of Common Sense? Uncommon
Sense? Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah,
drawing a blank.
Mm-hmm.
I also have read a book, because as I said, I got a 98-year-old mother who's a sweetie, reading, you know, Being Mortal.
Mm.
Great book if anybody has parents over the age of 75. Or as we start to get there, about,
is this Atul Gawande?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Phenomenal book. Phenomenal book. Just because it kind of deals, I think, a lot of what we're talking about too, which is, if we're not careful, we try to organize others' lives rather than help them lead their lives.
and organize our own.
And absolutely.
Right.
That's right.
Right. Yep. We distract ourselves from managing. I've definitely noticed that whenever I start to micromanage my children's lives, it's almost always because something feels out of order in my own, and it's easier right. to manage them or to pretend like I'm managing them.
Yep.
And do something about my own life.
Well, it's a little bit like when we're threatened, we tend to go back to our security blanket. I always say, if you're a leader, look for when someone's spending too much time on something they shouldn't. It means they're uncomfortable for some reason.
Yeah, well said. And for me, it's like they're clinging to the old S curve instead of being willing to jump onto the new one.
Exactly.
What was useful to you in this conversation?
Well, let me include both of us in this, so you don't, because I think every dialogue potentially has a wonderful positive impact. I believe that what you're trying to do, what I'm trying to do, together. If we don't establish and have honest, candid conversations, our world is doomed. Mm. And you want to have it with people that don't have an agenda. I think this conversation is about neither of us have really an agenda. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to do our part to help. The world kind of needs that positivity, and it needs that it can be okay. Because unfortunately, like we said before, bad news gets the front page. Good news gets the 42nd page. And I think we all have a responsibility in our field to say, how do we help people see that positive light? If you take 20% of the people, and these figures are obviously made up, but they're probably close. 20% of the people that would buy in everything we're saying, and 20% of the people think we're crazy. Mm-hmm. It's the 60% of the middle that we really have to work collectively at saying that they don't get bogged down and believe things can't change. It's like anything. I'll speak for myself, and I'm sure it's no different for you. If somebody gets one thing out of this podcast, that's a raving success.
Yep. Right.
Because I've long ago given up on these sit in front of a group of 500 people and all 500 people think you're wonderful. I could get you. Give me one person that changes part of their life in a positive direction. That's a worthwhile use of my time.
Yeah. You realize that you just went back. I mean, it's the bell curve, the standard distribution, but going back to the S curve, if you've got, 20% who are absolutely not going to agree with anything you have to say, 60% who are like, I'm not sure, but 20% who are like, yes, this is super helpful, then that's a lot of progress. That's why we continue to read books and listen to podcasts and we go to church and we do all these things that allow us to reinforce being better, because we're not going to get better once. We're better in a process. And so it's day by day by day by day, by minute,
absolutely,
by hour by minute. Any final thoughts as we wrap up?
I would just throw out a thought that's consistent with what we're talking about, which is recognize every person listening to this podcast can make a difference. And if they make a difference in their sphere of influence, the world tomorrow will be better than today. And I know that sounds kind of corny, but I believe it. I think people in, I believe in positive attribution. I think people are fundamentally good. We just hold them prisoner. And I get really scared when people go, well, I'm not going to associate them because they believe X. Well, that's not the way to change things, right? The way to change things is to have an open dialogue. Mm-hmm. Let people talk, hear their perspective, try to understand their perspective. You can't be them, but I can understand it. Mm-hmm. I can work hard to understand it. Mm. So that would be my... Mm.
So good. All right, Howard Morgan, thank you so much for joining us on the Disrupt Yourself podcast.
It was an honor, and thank you very much.
Three takeaways from my conversation with Howard. Number one, be an enabler, not a critic. It is hard to stay out of the politics of work. Everyone wants to succeed. Conflict is unavoidable. But Howard shared the value in being a moderator rather than being embroiled in workplace politics. Even when people don't agree with him, he can instantly diffuse criticism by respecting opposing viewpoints, a powerful skill. Don't play the game. Be competitive with yourself, not with others. As Howard says, be the best you can be, but not at the expense of other people. Number two. Hire the mavericks with good values. When building a team, it's easy to go with safe choices, but the best results come from a diversity of backgrounds and ideas and different stages of the S-curve of learning. Hiring a maverick, as Howard explains, also requires time investment. Mavericks are wounded. Their ideas are not always heard. But in a fast-moving company, these are the people with the creative solutions that can change the game. About a month in, they'll probably give you a little test, Howard says. Good leadership, it's actually a partnership. Give people the latitude to think critically about their own work. And if you talk to people and demonstrate respect, they will return your investment in them tenfold. Number three, trust, fairness, respect. Even when working with people he disagrees with, Howard always makes good on his commitments. He's fair to all parties, especially with contentious issues like labor relations. Be known as reliable and fair. Taking sides is not always the answer. If you enjoyed this episode, check out episode 233 with Jacqueline Novogratz, founder of Acumen, and episode 211 with Stephen M. R. Covey on the importance of trust. For the accelerants of growth I mentioned, go to episode 100, Take the Right Kinds of Risks, and episode 180, Step Back to Grow. And if you are ready to get smarter about your growth, our new book, Smart Growth, How to Grow Your People to Grow Your Company, is now available for pre-order wherever books are sold. We'll include a link in the show notes. Thank you again to Howard Morgan for being our guest and to you for listening. Thank you to our team, Matt Silverman, producer, Whitney Jobe, audio engineer and editor, Steve Ludwig, assistant producer, and Cassidy Simpson, production assistant. I'm Whitney Johnson, reminding you that if you want to be an agent of disruption, first become its subject. Disrupt yourself. Disruption.